Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In the wake of 2020's wildfires, the Willamette and Umpqua National Forests have proposed hundreds of miles of 200-foot-wide linear clearcuts throughout the forest in the name of hazard tree removal. These projects would damage habitat for listed species, impair water quality, and remove large, valuable old trees that could stand for decades to come, providing habitat for a wide variety of fire-dependent species. The Forest Service has admitted as much that these projects are timber grabs and they want to move fast, but they are being opposed by conservation groups who have engaged in direct actions and filed lawsuits to stop the logging. Today we talk with Rebecca White, a lawyer with Cascadia Wildlands, and Madeline Cowan, grassroots and digital organizer with Cascadia Wildlands, about legal and direct action efforts to save these old-growth forests from destructive clear-cutting. Rebecca, welcome back to Locus Focus, and Madeline, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
One of the things that I want to do today is to help audiences imagine what the landscape is like in the post-fire world after the mega fires of 2020. So I wanted to have you start by describing what's gone on with the woods, what it looks like now, and then we'll get from there into some of the more dire consequences of the fire besides just the burn. So I'll have you start with you, Rebecca.
I know folks heard from you in your most recent episode on the developments in the Clackamas Valley. And I think what's important for folks to know is that the 2020 Labor Day fires, as we call them all collectively, more or less burned every major river valley on the western side of the Cascades. And they were weather driven. We had this unusual, very high speed, very warm and dry east wind event. And it took some fires that were burning in a relatively minor way and drove them down our river valleys towards the Willamette Valley floor in the Umpqua Valley. So Clackamas working south, we had major fires in the Santiam River Canyon, in the McKenzie River Canyon. The Willamette Canyon was more or less skipped, and then the North Umpqua River Canyon. And then, of course, there were some other fires in Southwest Oregon and Eastern Oregon as well. But as far as the western slopes, that was kind of the landscape we were looking at. And all of these fires burned through a variety of land ownerships. So anywhere from the Bureau of Land Management to the U.S. Forest Service, some state parks like the Santiam State Forest had quite a bit of burning, state forests, I should say, a little bit into Silver Falls State Park. And a lot of the land that burned was private timberland as well. So we see that there's been a huge wave of post-fire logging in the wake of those fires. There was a huge amount of logging. There's basically sort of been a wave of so-called salvage logging, post-fire logging in the wake of those fires. And basically that has happened across every land ownership. And I know Madeline has spent a lot of time out there visiting what the wake of that has been. So maybe she can give some more details on what it looks like on the ground.
Yeah, what we're seeing on the ground where it hasn't been logged is really a remarkable landscape, especially on our public lands. There was a mixed burn severity, so varying levels of tree mortality and soil burn severity on the ground. And if within areas that were both had higher mortality and then some of the, you know, areas that were just lightly charred, where those are equally beautiful in my mind as far as the post fire forest goes. I remember going up to the Brighton Bush watershed and near the Opal Creek wilderness, and I was walking around on a road. There was a road closure, so I just walked up the road, and there were these giant trees that were experienced a very hot fire, and so they were kind of falling all over each other, but some of them were still standing. And it was this like wild, almost sea of complex, intertwined branches and big trees. And, you know, 5 years ago, I may have seen that landscape and thought, oh my gosh, this is a devastation for this stand of forest that I love so much. But after becoming somewhat radicalized and starting to understand a little bit more about basic fire ecology, I now see that landscape in a different way, and I see basically a boom of biodiversity and or pyrodiversity in that area. So I know that lots of critters are going to be using that area and coming back, and that forest is still incredibly valuable for both storing carbon and protecting watersheds and communities, as long as they're not logged and taken, and those trees aren't taken away.
Well, in the wake of the Biscuit Fire back in 2002, I think that was a wake-up call for a lot of people, including myself, to really learn about the importance of the role of fire in the landscape in the Northwest and actually across much of the world. I spent some time in the Biscuit Burn a few years after the fire and had a really good tour guide who was pointing out all the incredible bursts of life that were just abundant through this one trail we went on. I think for a lot of people in the Portland area, the 2017 Eagle Creek fire was, again, a great lesson in the important role of fire and the beauty of fire. And I had many friends who had come back from their first trip to the gorge once the trail started reopening again, describing the ghost forests and the beauty that was there. It's been fascinating to watch that fire, how it changed the landscape and how the forest has been recovering. And also another place where I love that burned a number of years ago, which was the Vista Ridge Trail. And that was also, it goes through a wilderness area and it could not be logged. In fact, there were signs up all over saying, wilderness area, do not cut trees after that fire. And I've been watching that place come back now for the last 10 years. This seems to be a different situation. And that's what I've been hearing from everybody who's been out in the woods since the fires from last year. So what is the difference in the way that the post-fire landscape is being managed, particularly in the Willamette and the Umpqua National Forest, compared to how it was managed in the gorge and in the Mountain Hood Wilderness area after the Vista Ridge fire?
Sure. Well, there's a couple of pieces to that in my mind. One of them just has to do with forest leadership. I think the Willamette National Forest leadership and the Mount Hood National Forest leadership just take a slightly different tack on post-fire recovery and whether they include that as part of their financial planning and to the extent that they do that. The other big piece has to do with land use classification. So like you mentioned, wilderness areas are not open to logging even after a fire. There are other land use classifications within the Forest Service system that are a result of the Northwest Forest Plan, like the reserve system, the late successional reserves that are meant to provide habitat for late successional species like spotted owls and others, the riparian reserves that are meant to provide good habitat for aquatic species like salmon and bull trout, that are listed as well under the Endangered Species Act. So those lands are not supposed to be salvage logged after a fire. But what we are seeing on the west side is that a lot of the land that burned is not under a protected land use characteristic. And so it's available for the agencies to more or less clear cut. And I think there's probably an intersection of Trump era guidance that was still in play in the late 2020 after these fires happened, and some holdover leadership decisions from that administration. I think there's also perennial funding problems with our federal forestry agencies, and that has to do with congressional decisions. And there has been a lot of pressure on our federal agencies to do a lot of logging. And so I think, you know, what's happening with the Willamette National Forest, and I can get into, you know, some of the legal aspects and litigation too later if you want to, but, you know, more or less what the Willamette National Forest has proposed to do that is very large scale and potentially very environmentally damaging is to do what we call a linear clear cut, or they call it hazard tree removal, along about 400 miles of road in the Willamette National Forest. So there's a couple of things that are pretty outsized in scale about this. One is that the entirety of the highway distance that ODOT was responsible for clearing after the fires was 120 miles. So if the Willamette National Forest is looking at clearing 400 miles that are sort of hidden back in the forest, that is a ton of road and that is a lot of trees and a lot of volume, and a lot of that is very big old trees that they're going to be going for. The other thing that's really disturbing about it is that the majority of those roads are called maintenance level 1 or 2 roads, and so maintenance level 1 roads are closed. They're not open to passenger vehicles. So there's certainly no public safety justification for opening a road that is not available for people to use and doesn't direct people to any recreational sites. And so, you know, we're definitely in support of the Forest Service providing safety on roads that people actually use and want to use to access their forests for foraging and for camping and other recreation, but certainly not to do huge linear clear cuts along roads that aren't even used. And I think the other sort of piece, which is a thread throughout this entire discussion, is that the agency has done this process without full environmental review and has attempted to circumvent public input on this process. And we've seen this pattern over and over in ODOT, Oregon Department of Forestry, U.S. Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, trying to rush through these post-fire projects without involving the public.
Well, I got an email from Nick Cady, your colleague, a few weeks ago, talking about this rushed way that the logging is being proposed and being carried out. And he referred to it as a timber grab, which he said, in fact, it's sort of it being acknowledged by the Forest Service that it's a timber grab. So what does that mean?
Well, I think it means that the Forest Service, in meetings that I've had with them, has actually acknowledged we can't afford to do some of the restoration work that we want to do unless we get money from logging these big trees, because the contractors that we would hire to do this work will actually ask us to pay them for the privilege of taking down small diameter trees because they're not worth as much to them. And in return, more or less, they're going to need to take some really large diameter trees so they can make some profit on the deal. So that could be what he meant.
What is the percentage of large diameter trees that are being taken out?
Well, we don't know. And the reason we don't know is that they didn't do an environmental analysis. That's the kind of information that would normally come out in an environmental analysis or an environmental impact statement. And that's part of what we're arguing in court, is that the agency is required to do a full environmental review and disclose all of this kind of information to the public. But none of us know because the agency hasn't told us.
Well, there's been a lot of reporting about what was going on the Clackamas River Corridor. And that was the Forest Service who did the cutting there. And the other thing that got a lot of reporting was the ODOT cutting along Highway 22 along the Santiam River. And all these scandalous stories coming out about these people who had absolutely no credentials at all to be doing the cutting. And there was drug use and there was all kinds of strange things happening. Can you compare what's going on in the Willamette National Forest in the less visible cutting sheds compared to what was going on in places that were more visible and got more publicity?
In the Willamette National Forest, in these kind of areas where it wasn't as visible, and in addition to the Willamette National Forest, there's also been similar cutting kind of outside of the public view in the Umpqua National Forest, as well as up in the Malahood National Forest. But in comparison to, I mean, really there isn't much of a difference from what we're seeing along the roadsides and the large linear clear cuts along the roadsides and what is happening kind of in the back of the forest. But in addition to the projects that are happening along these roads that Rebecca mentioned that are already closed to the public, they've also changed previous timber sales, specifically one that's in the Willamette National Forest in the Brighton Bush watershed where I was just talking about. They changed a project called the Highway 46 project that Cascadia Wildlands and other people in Portland and the community at large have been tracking since it was first proposed. So this Highway 46 project progressed and progressed and went through the whole NEPA process and basically concluded that they were going to do kind of some selective thinning projects on not the older stands. But after the fire happened, they completely changed the whole contract of that timber sale to do basically blanket clear cutting on all of those units. So they changed it from selective thinning to post-fire complete salvage on the forest at large and not just along the roadsides. So that's another one of our big issues that we're tracking.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Madeline Cowan, who's a grassroots and digital organizer with Cascadia Wildlands, along with Rebecca White, who's a lawyer with Cascadia Wildlands. And we're talking about legal and direct action efforts to save the old growth forests that are being destroyed by post-fire logging in the wake of the fires last year, the Labor Day fires in 2020. I'm curious if there has been the same kind of awareness and perhaps whistleblowing about really bad practices that go beyond even bad logging practices. For example, the abusive kinds of working conditions that the people who were logging Highway 22 were doing, as well as the alleged drug use that was going on. Has that been a problem with these other cuts as well?
Madeline might know more. I haven't heard those kinds of outlandish stories, and I think that's part of why the ODOT management or mismanagement of the highway clearing process received so much press, is because, you know, something like 8 whistleblowers came forward to say this is really, really bad. The Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management, for what it's worth, do have a lot of experience managing roadside projects and logging projects, and they've worked with most of these contracting timber companies for decades. So they've got their working relationships worked out. So I think that they're on the up and up as far as that, but I do think, like what Madeline was talking about a few minutes ago with the Highway 46 project and the Forest Service quietly changing those contracts without notifying the public, this was perhaps, in my mind, showing that there's maybe a little bit too close of a relationship between the federal government and some of its timber contractors. If they were organizing contract changes on public lands, that's cutting publicly owned trees that were supposed to be thinned for restoration purposes and instead are clear cut after a fire. And also happened to increase the board feet that the buyer would be getting out of the sale, as well as their projected profit at the mill. I find that all to be pretty challenging to swallow, and that's why we're litigating it.
Well, I remember that the Detroit Ranger Station, that Ranger District, has been kind of notorious for many years. In fact, I think it was the target of, quote, eco-terrorists a number of years ago. But is there a problem with the Detroit Ranger District? I mean, are they even more out of whack with what would be in the best interests of the forest than the other ranger districts?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of the Forest Service and federal land management agencies are working mostly in concert with the timber industry. And there are some people in some pockets of the agencies that perhaps have the best interest for the public. But in a large part, the Detroit Ranger District is just as... you know, going after the timber as any other ranger district because of these board feet mandates that they are legally required to get. So, and agencies do a very good job of really pushing that narrative towards the public. We have no control over what we can or cannot do. We just have to follow the protocol. So it's these larger policies and board feet mandates that are ruling at the end of the day, but the timber industry is benefiting the most from that while the public suffers.
Well, one of the things that I found interesting when I was talking with Michael Crocta last week with BARC was that the Mount Hood National Forest is being way more cooperative with working with environmental groups like BARC and many other groups that are calling on really holding back on the post-fire logging and doing it with a lot more sensitivity. But it doesn't seem to be the case with the Willamette National Forest and the Umpqua National Forest. One of the things that Michael told me was that Mount Hood National Forest reached out to BARC because they were concerned about litigation. They wanted to know what they could do so that BARC wouldn't litigate. So, Rebecca, what has the Willamette National Forest done so that you are litigating?
Well, I would say that we had similar discussions with the Willamette National Forest. And I think, you know, several months ago, the leadership of the forest agreed to meet with us and representatives of several other groups that we also work with, like Oregon Wild and the Craig Law Center, who's currently representing all of us as a group of co-plaintiffs in that litigation. And, you know, I think from my perspective, we said we need you to do some environmental review on this and to involve the public in this process and to answer the kind of questions like what you asked earlier. Well, how many big trees are you going to cut down? And is there a spotted owl critical habitat there? And do you expect that you may be impacting Chinook waterways or where bull trout habitat? And none of that was done. And they knew very well that I think litigation would be forthcoming if they weren't willing to back off. Another thing that the Mount Hood National Forest did was see the logic of the argument that it doesn't make sense to clear roads for the purposes of public safety when those roads are closed to the public. And so they dropped, I don't know the number of miles, but quite a few miles of roads that they had talked about clearing, they dropped from their plans. And they agreed to do some further environmental review going forward. So I think we hold that up as an example of a really excellent way that the Forest Service interfaced with the community and groups representing community members and really did try to take a look at what folks living in the Mount Hood region would like to see for their national forest. And for whatever reason, the Willamette National Forest just isn't going down that path right now. But we can always hold out hope, and we do keep reaching out, and lots of our allies and other conservation groups are in conversations with them as well.
Well, what's happening with the litigation? What exactly are you litigating?
Okay, so there's quite a few things. On the Willamette National Forest, we are litigating that case that Madeline spoke about where up in the Brighton Bush area, the Forest Service changed the contracts without letting the public know. And that's for area unit salvage. So we're talking about big clear cuts, not just roadside work there. So that's one piece. And in that case, we're also represented by the Craig Law Center. So they're a great group out of Portland that helps nonprofit groups litigate, typically in federal court. And so and I know you've had Ralph Bloomers on before, and he's one of the co-founders of Craig. And the other case is litigating this roadside hazard tree removal project along 400 miles in the Willamette National Forest without doing environmental review. And our argument there is that they need to do environmental review under NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, and fully involve the public. And as Madeline mentioned, the Umpqua National Forest, without any request for public input whatsoever, is also doing the same thing, even more quietly, I would say, than Willamette National Forest. And we're also involved in litigation there.
How much logging has actually gone on so far?
It has started in some places. Contracts have been sold. Some of it happened months ago, before, as far as we understand, before even the documents and the decision was made and publicized. Some of it has been behind closed areas of the forest. And so, you know, we don't know because we can't go back there legally to find out. And they're not telling us. But we do know that some has happened, some is ongoing, and quite a bit remains to be done.
One of the things I think might be helpful for listeners, can you describe the delineation between the Mount Hood National Forest, the Willamette National Forest, and the Umpqua National Forest? Where are those lines drawn?
Yeah, so I'm sure a lot of your Portland listeners are familiar with the Mount Hood National Forest. Covers the area directly east of Portland, and then to the part of the east side of Mount Hood, and then kind of going south, the line between the Willamette National Forest and the Mount Hood National Forest is kind of north of that Brighton Bush watershed I referenced a couple of times. So you can actually drive on Highway 46 and go by Brighton Bush and then get up into the Mount Hood National Forest. Then as you travel down, and that's the Detroit Ranger District. And so then within the Willamette National Forest, you kind of go down, you'll go through the Santiam River and then to the Mackenzie River to the south. And then this all in the Willamette National Forest also borders some wilderness areas also kind of at the foothills of the Cascades before you get over into Eastern Oregon, Central and Eastern Oregon. And it's really complicated also because there's a couple of BLM spatterings in between everything a little bit, and then also some state land. But as you go south a little bit farther and hit the Umpqua watershed, then you'll be in the Umpqua National Forest. And then adjacent to the Umpqua National Forest to the west is the Roseburg BLM district, which has a lot of really beloved forest down there as well.
Madeline, you described the beauty of the burned forest, and you were describing it, I guess, before the logging started. So I wanted to have you describe the impact that the post-fire logging has on the beauty of what would be a natural ghost forest.
Yeah, definitely. What's really interesting about a forest that has been logged after a fire is that it's going to look, you know, after the fire, while the forest is coming back and while those new shoots are coming up, it kind of has this black and muddy look to it. And when those large trees or any kind of trees are removed with post-fire logging, the shoots and the foliage that's going to come up afterwards is going to take advantage of the light. And a lot of those species can be bring opportunity for invasive species to spread there. But what you get when you remove those trees is an increase in sedimentation into our waterways. You get a lot more sunlight on the ground, and so that forest and that area is going to be dry out a lot faster than a forest that still has the shade of the trees. And then additionally, even when there's a downed log, imagine a big old growth tree that fell down many years ago, and it's kind of one of those classic nursery trees. Even after a burn, that log is going to be holding in a lot of water, and that is essential for continuing the filtration process of our drinking water. So by removing all of those trees, removing carbon from the forest, you're increasing sedimentation and increasing landslide risk to communities, and you're decreasing the watershed's ability to filter water for many communities' drinking water.
Well, I remember when I was walking through a part of the Biscuit Burn many years ago, and there's a trail that hadn't been logged. It was actually a wilderness area, the Babyfoot Lake area, and my guide pointed out what he described as the Venetian blind effect, because all the snags that were standing did this thing where there'd be these little shadows, like a Venetian blind. Why are those shadows so important?
Those shadows that are cast onto the landscape are they're both providing the shade for the new forest that's coming up, but even if it's a dead tree and even if or if the tree survived, that tree that's still standing is providing almost as much, if not way more, biodiversity and life opportunities for incoming woodpeckers and many bird species. With more bird species, they're creating cavities in those standing dead snags after in a burned forest. Those cavities become habitat for little critters. Those bring in the raptors, the bigger birds, and also kind of our apex predators as well. So there's so much biodiversity that comes to a forest after it's been burned if it's left there. So the shadows that we hope remain there are really essential for continuing the life of the forest.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Rebecca White, a lawyer with Cascadia Wildlands, and Madeline Cowan, grassroots and digital organizer with Cascadia Wildlands. And we're talking about legal and direct action efforts to save the old growth forests that were burned last summer in the great Labor Day fires of 2020, and to save them from destructive clear cutting. I wanted to talk now about the connections and the intersections between the work that you do, Rebecca, in the court, so to speak, with litigation, and the work that you do, Madeline, on the ground with direct action. And so let's first start talking a little bit more about the litigation and the reason for it, and then we can talk about how that is supported by what happens on the ground. So I'll start with you, Rebecca.
Great. So part of our motto is, you know, we want to inspire action in the forests, in the courts, and in the streets. And, you know, we are trying to support with our work an overall regional movement towards a wilder and healthier Cascadia for all who live here, right? And that includes wildlife, and that includes people, and that includes every living thing in this region. So we're using all the tools at our disposal, and we have a very active group of folks who do our field checking. And in many cases, you know, we find out about destructive logging projects going on in our forests only because somebody was out there and called us up to tell us about it. And certainly the agencies didn't notify us. And certainly the agencies didn't publish something in the newspaper to provide a public register. So, you know, the legal backstop to the work that these folks are doing on the ground is to try to help direct the agencies towards involving the public more in the land that the public owns. And so what we have going on here, and I know we've referenced this a couple of times, is we have agency after agency, federal and state, moving forward with projects in a fairly underhanded way and not involving the public in their decision making and not providing information to the public about what they're planning to do. You know, much as I hate to say it, I think we now realize that our future is going to involve more wildfires in Oregon. At least they are a regular occurrence. You know, forests in Oregon and the Pacific Northwest have burned for millions of years. Our forests are fire adapted. We know that this is going to be part of our future from now on. So we need to figure out how we're going to respond. And we're hoping with litigation to show the agencies that we're not okay with the way that they behaved after the 2020 fires. And we don't want them to go forward with projects in this way. We have vast community support against these types of logging projects in watersheds that people dearly love. We have forest defenders who are active in their home place, in the Santiam Canyon, in the North Umpqua, who love a particular grove of trees and they want to defend that grove of trees. And that is where it's happening. But if we can get the courts to give some top-down direction to the agencies to help steer their behavior after future fires, then we'll consider that a win.
What's the status of your current lawsuits?
So we've just filed and we're about to have a hearing on a preliminary injunction for the Willamette National Forest 400-mile roadside clearing project. And that hearing is actually next week, so we hope to have a decision on that soon. Depending on how the injunction is worded, and if we win it, then that logging would not be able to go ahead until the lawsuit is decided, maybe later this year, maybe next year. As far as the contract change case, we're at a similar state. We're just behind by a couple of weeks on that one, so we should be having some information out of that one soon. And there's actually another piece of litigation we haven't talked about yet that has to do with the Bureau of Land Management, not the U.S. Forest Service. This is another last-minute gift from the Trump administration, which was a new categorical exclusion that allows the Bureau of Land Management to log up to 3,000 acres after a big fire without any environmental review or public input. And so that was sort of a timber industry gift that I believe was signed towards the end of 2020. And unfortunately, the Northwest Oregon Bureau of Land Management determined that they wanted to go ahead and log about 1,000 acres of the McKenzie watershed after the Holiday Farm fire, using that new Trump rule. And so we're challenging that in court with the help of the Western Environmental Law Center. And that one, we'll know more about that one later this year too.
So what are the prospects, do you think? How likely do you think you are that you're gonna prevail on these lawsuits?
Well, who knows, but certainly precedent is in our favor. So EPIC, which is a group out of Northern California, sued the Forest Service for a very similar project a few years ago and won in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the ruling basically says that the Forest Service can't use this kind of categorical exclusion to do widespread, wide width hazard logging as they're trying to do and call it road maintenance. And so we have pretty good case law on point. A federal court in the Eastern District of California recently stopped a timber sale that the Forest Service was attempting to do of a similar nature on the Sequoia National Forest. And so it seems that the trends are pointing in our favor.
Well, these are lower court decisions, though, and of course, all of our fears these days are if things get kicked up to the Supreme Court, then we're in trouble. So how likely is it that any of these cases would actually go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, I think we're out of the woods with the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision. So with any luck, that'll be binding precedent on these cases. And the Supreme Court has already announced its docket, I think, for this term. And so none of these cases are on it at this point. They do like to use something called the shadow docket, where they make decisions without doing the full oral argument and briefing. I don't think it's super likely that this would come to pass. Fingers crossed. Not a great lineup at the Supreme Court right now.
Well, Madeline, meanwhile, what's happening on the ground? There was a lot of talk in the summer about tree sitting. I know that was for a different issue. It wasn't about post-fire logging. But what are people doing on the ground? And how likely is it that there might be some more tree sitting going on in the woods here in Oregon?
Yeah, well, I can't say for sure on that. But I know that people... I know how important it is for the public to engage with this as much as possible, because like Rebecca says, the lawyers are going to court and they're reading through all the complex legalese and doing all of that that hard work, but it's largely ineffective if there isn't the public that they're claiming to represent to back them up. So a large part of what I do is I bring the public to the forest, and so we can actually get the boots on the ground and see what's happening out there, and so that the public can not just read something in a newspaper or what the agency is telling us, and then actually forming our own opinion and seeing what's going on in our public lands. And so that's one aspect of what's happening on the ground. We'll do what's called field checking, where we get those boots on the ground. Compare what the Forest Service or the BLM is saying that the stand conditions that they want are and what we're actually seeing. So oftentimes when we're doing these trips, we will find streams or waterways that aren't on their maps that require buffers. And so and we'll inform the public agencies about those, and that will reduce the unit that they want to cut. With post-fire logging, it's a little bit different because, for one, it's really hard to access a lot of our burned forests, and additionally, it can be dangerous to walk through those stands because of how fragile those trees are, and so some of the tactics that we've used over the last year in opposition to all of the post-fire logging is we've gotten incredible media coverage. Ted Sickinger with the Oregonian did some really good coverage on what's happening, especially with the ODOT controversy. Additionally, we've held rallies at the Detroit Rangers District. There was a rally of with representatives of different organizations and community members. We held a rally in Salem earlier in the spring, spring of 2021. And then also there are other people who are taking more traditional direct action measures and really putting the pressure directly on the atrocious operations that are happening. So this past summer, there were people who got in the way of a logging operation that was done by helicopter. So what was happening was that it was along Highway 126 on the Mackenzie River. It was ODOT doing roadside cutting. And those people who were there, they saw that they were cutting way up high into the hillside, way far away from the road, way away from any sort of danger to drivers on the thruway there. And they got onto the logging equipment and they said, no, you're not going to do this. We're going to occupy this place. And they actually successfully stopped operations for the rest of that day. So people are, and then there's been other efforts that I've heard of of people actually going in and changing the paint color on the trees that are supposed to be cut. And so, you know, there's people are finding creative ways to slow down what's happening on the ground, to gain attention from agencies, and then also to kind of support the legal efforts that are happening in the court. So it really takes all of us.
So how much have you actually been able to slow down the logging?
There have been, like I mentioned, these kind of clandestine efforts have been happening in the forests, and they've been successful in slowing it down, but really the scale at which the logging is happening is really hard for a small group of people in various different communities throughout Oregon. And so what really is necessary is both large decisions being made at the federal level, but also more people feeling inspired to take action to their own hands, look at what people have done over this past summer and are currently doing, and take inspiration from that. And you know, it's really bad out there on the ground, and so it's really going to take a lot of us getting involved in any way we can.
How successful do you think that direct action can be in the long run? It does seem like, I think about the long history of tree sitting in the Northwest and in Northern California. I don't know exactly how much that really impeded the timber industry's ability to do it, massive clear cutting, particularly in the 90s. Do you think that kind of action can actually help?
Yeah, I think that, you know, imagine if people hadn't taken action back then, you know, how big of a difference how different it would be now, right? So although the actions that people, individuals or groups of people are taking may not appear to have full of force and, full effect right then and there, it's the combination of all of those small actions, including people writing letters to the editor, including people, speaking to their legislative bodies, all those pieces working in tandem are part of this larger movement that is incredibly effective. And our voice, the public's voice, has been heard on this. And I think also since the 90s, the forest, whatever you might want to call it, the forest defense movement has matured a lot. And there are new tactics being used, more collaboration being built with frontline communities, rural communities, indigenous communities, and also the movement recognizes that, you know, that it does take all of these pieces to make something happen. One tree sitter in the middle of the woods isn't going to fix a whole issue of logging our old growth forests in the Pacific Northwest. It's, you know, it's everyone coming together.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Madeline Cowan, who's the grassroots and digital organizer with Cascadia Wildlands, and Rebecca White, a lawyer with Cascadia Wildlands, about efforts, both legal and direct action, to save old-growth forests from the threat of destructive clear-cutting in the wake of the massive fires last year. I keep going back to almost 20 years ago, 2002, the Biscuit Fire, which to me seemed like a real watershed moment in terms of fire, the awareness in the region and probably around the world of the importance of fire and the real dangers of post-fire logging. We seem to keep coming around to the same debate over and over. The fires that burned last summer were probably, twice or three times as much area as the Biscuit Fire did, and of course covered most of Western Oregon. What lessons do you think were learned back then that have been brought forward to this? And what lessons do you see that are coming out of the response to the kinds of logging that's happening now in the burned areas that we need to really address so that next time there's a fire, which could be next year, we're not going through the same thing again?
Well, I can weigh in on the sort of administrative process that happened after the Biscuit Fire. You know, the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management did a joint environmental impact statement to plan for their post-fire logging. And a lot of community and environmental action fought against the decision for them to do some of that. And that is what level of environmental review is required after a fire and before a massive clear-cut logging project like was proposed in the Biscuit Fire. In these most recent fires, none of the agencies have done any level of environmental review, much less a full environmental impact statement, which the preparation of can take a year or two. So that means they've slowed down and they've really thought about what they're doing and they've really carefully calculated. They're not just rushing ahead to log the timber before it becomes unmarketable. So in that sense, there kind of is no lesson we can take, on, at least on the administrative side, because the agencies are behaving in an unprecedented manner. It's fairly shocking that they are trying to do these large-scale projects without environmental review. And so I think in some senses, this has been a big lesson for us above and beyond what could have been learned from the Biscuit Fire, because we have seen that the agencies are willing to move forward without taking the appropriate measures and precautions to make sure they're not going to commit irreversible environmental damage and damage to communities. And so that's one big thing that I find has been a really remarkable shift in agency administration in the past decade or so, and it was certainly intensified during the Trump administration, but it's been an ongoing process, which is agencies doing less and less environmental review of their actions and trying to move actions faster and faster.
Well, one of the similarities I see between the Biscuit Fire response and last year's fires response on the part of the feds is that, in my opinion, if the roadless rule that the Clinton administration put in place minutes before Clinton was no longer president and George W. Bush took over, if that rule hadn't been rescinded by the Bush administration really easily, then all that logging in the Biscuit Fire wouldn't have happened. I mean, there would have been some very thoughtful thinning and hazard tree removal, but all the stuff that was in the backcountry wouldn't have happened. And then finally, I believe it was the end of 2006, that roadless rule was upheld and it was reinstated, and that stopped the logging in the Biscuit Fire. There had been a lot of destructive stuff happening, but there was a lot that was saved as a result of that. It seems like the same thing happened as a result of Trump, and we're still living under the nemesis of the Trump administration's horrific forest policies. Do you see that that is an issue, and that that is one of the things that we need to really address about maybe really watching who becomes president of the United States in the future?
Absolutely. And certainly congressional action is a big part, too. I think Madeline mentioned before that a lot of this really bad activity by the agencies is being driven by timber targets, which are congressionally mandated. So until Congress stops doing that, the agencies are going to scramble around wherever they can to get to meet their timber targets. And the Forest Service has pretty high timber targets. Congress, folks in Congress are continually pressing them to increase those timber targets. And the same goes for the Bureau of Land Management. Their timber targets are even worse. So those are big structural level changes that need to happen. And they're at the root of the vast majority of this. The other pieces that are kind of interesting to me is a greater awareness of forest carbon role in the climate crisis. So this is not something that was as well known during the time of the Biscuit Fire, but of course is front of mind for everyone these days. And I actually read an interesting statistic about the Biscuit Fire that there's sort of a misconception that wildfires are contributing greatly to carbon emissions. You've seen the sort of horrible scare statistics about, you know, California's fires are erasing all the gains that the state has made in its fuel efficiency standards. And it's actually not true. It's come from some sort of like incorrect statistical analysis. And only 10% of Oregon's carbon emissions for the year of the Biscuit Fire were from the fire. It's not like it's this great emergency. And when you're seeing wildfire smoke, what you're seeing is almost entirely water vapor. Only about 5% of it is actually carbon. The vast majority of the carbon stays in a burned forest, even if it's completely burned to charcoal, and it stays in the soil as well. And as soon as that forest starts to resprout, if it's not logged, it starts to sequester more carbon, and it's a very healthy and biodiverse area. So I think we have that lesson we've learned in the intervening years too, and we have an administration that at least pays pretty good lip service to carbon storage, and we're working very hard to talk to the administration about protecting our old growth Pacific Northwest forests as a strategic carbon reserve, as part of our climate mitigation plan, and as part of protecting 30% of the lands in the United States as part of the 30 by 30 initiative. Interestingly, in reference to the roadless rule, you know, the Biden administration recently reapplied it to the Tongass National Forest and issued a moratorium on old growth logging, except for some very small scale logging for indigenous uses across the entire 9 million acre Tongass National Forest. So we see no reason why the Biden administration couldn't do something similar here. You know, we do have some proposed mature and old growth timber sales, for example, on the Willamette National Forest and quite a few on Bureau of Land Management lands. And those are absolutely unjustifiable in this era of climate change.
And are those timber sales that you're litigating?
Not yet. They haven't gotten to that point. We're still working out some details with the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management and still negotiating and putting pressure for them to change or drop those sales.
And one of those sales is where there was a tree sitting last summer. Is that correct?
That's right. That's Black Country.
Mm-hmm. How well do you think that the Oregon congressional delegation is doing? I mean, there was a time when everybody who was elected to any kind of office in Oregon was pro-timber. And I think Barbara Roberts was the first statewide elected official as governor who was not in the pocket of the timber industry. And that was like 1990. It seems to me that Peter DeFazio has gotten a lot better because he's actually said some very strong things about the outrageous post-fire logging that was going on last spring. And I think that Ron Wyden seems to have gotten better, too. So I'm just wondering, what's your take on our congressional delegation and how can we make them even better?
Yeah, Congressman DeFazio actually came out against the flat country timber sale that we were just referring to. It's one of the most egregious timber sales that has happened in the Willamette National Forest in years. It has, you know, over 2,000 acres of old growth and mature logging, and about 80% of it is, or 80% of the 100 million board feet that they're getting from it is from old growth mature logging. But so we are really thankful to DeFazio for coming out against that sale. We're hoping that our other climate champions like Senator Wyden and Merkley also come out in support of and kind of stand with DeFazio and put congressional pressure on the agencies to stop this timber sale, as well as other sales that are happening on the Bureau of Land Management lands and others.
Well, what do you want listeners to do to help to save these forests before they are all under the chainsaw's grip?
There's plenty that we can all do. Like I mentioned earlier, not everyone needs to be going and sitting in trees. If people want to do that, that's wonderful. And I think that is a good way to put forward a good message. The tree sitters that were at Flat Country early in the fall, late summer, I really loved their message. It said, if you buy this sale, you're buying us. And so I think that kind of overarching narrative is really true to the forest defense movement in the Pacific Northwest and Oregon. You're by going after these our last remaining old growth and mature forests, and you're really buying a really fiery public that has been long known to be against this type of logging. And people should continue to do that work in the forest. People can also get involved with organizations like Cascadia Wildlands or BARC, other organizations that do this kind of field checking work, getting those boots on the ground and looking at timber sales and writing really strong public comments to put pressure on the public agencies. Additionally, writing letters to the editor, calling up your senator, those are really effective ways. I know it's kind of tried and true and you've heard it before, but it's really important to do. Also, you know, talk with your community, talk with your friends and your neighbors about what's happening, and You know, it takes just a couple of people with loud voices to make a difference. And so host a rally in your community, or you know, there's plenty of ways to engage, but it really takes all of us. So I hope you'll join us.
Well, Madeline and Rebecca, it's great to have you on. Thank you for all the work that you're doing, and I hope to speak to you again really soon.
Thanks so much, Barbara. Really appreciate it.
We've been talking with Rebecca White and Madeline Cowan with Cascadia Wildlands, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Kibwe Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our Kibwe Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the Kibwe staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping Kibwe on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us by becoming a member of Kibwe, or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm/give, or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll rebroadcast an interview I did with Richard Heinberg in September. We'll go out with some music by Sweet Thunder. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.